Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Live from the gleaming, streamlined, state-of-the-art studios of OutlawRadioLive.com, nestled in our secret bunker somewhere in the Los Angeles area. It's a well-concealed secret. This is True Crime Uncensored. I am Burl Bear, that guy right there. That's Mark Boyer, fact-checker, co-host, wonderful human being.
Joe, welcome. Hello, Joe.
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, there he is. Hey.
The criminals and cowboys.
Yeah, hey. It's Joel Blazer. I was listening to Joel Blazer. We had him on the show. It seems like it was just 2016. That was a good year.
It seems like yesterday, but it was 8 years ago.
8 years goes by fast, man.
Yeah, I have an opening question.
And that's Mark Boyer.
You sent Burl some notes along with some pictures.
Yes, he did.
Don't you think you're just bragging a little bit there?
What?
Oh, come on. Do you see what the shape this guy's in?
Well, he's in great shape.
Yeah, it's annoying.
It's all the psychedelics he took.
That's a very recent picture, too. It's not one of those ones that's from 12 years ago.
No, that's the ones I use, the ones from 12 years ago. That's how I look in my mind.
You go on a date and you see somebody and they're like, wait, who are you?
Yeah. Hey, Burl, it doesn't matter what year, you still look like nothing.
I still look like nothing. Nothing says loving like something from my oven. Oh, Joel, it's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me.
You had a fun life. You're a deadhead. You've seen the Grateful Dead more than I have. I've seen the Grateful Dead twice. Once at the Sky River Rock Festival up in the Pacific Northwest, back when Pigpen was with them.
Wow! Like 71?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, it was before he died, obviously. And then I saw him in the Seattle Center arena, something like that. People were throwing beer bottles. It was a rowdy crowd. And then, of course, I saw him with Bob Dylan, Dylan on the Dead. Did you see that one, Dylan on the Dead?
No, I saw Dylan in the Dead in, like, 1988, I never listened to a recording that old with Dylan and the Dead. That's amazing. I mean, is that when you're talking back then?
Yeah. And when they did Like a Rolling Stone, and they did How Does It Feel? They had a giant mirror that they put on the crowd with lights shining off of it. It was far out.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. And your co-host over here saw them in 75, summer of 75. And then later at the Orpheum in San Francisco. Where those tickets were by themselves works of art. Remember?
Yes. They're like dripping with, like somebody must have been on LSD when they created them. You kind of get that impression.
Paisley?
Well, they were embossed and they're black and color. It was beautiful.
That's why Gary Nassif in Las Vegas was famous for the tickets to the shows he produced were all works of art done by, Jan and Dean.
And those were like a different era back then.
Collectors,
you know, they did that for the tickets for the 1990 Europe tour, the Frankfurt, Hamburg, Berlin, and the London shows. The concert posters were Rick Griffin artwork, but then the ticket stubs, they were like as big as a modern day boarding pass, thick and embossed. And they had his artwork on there. They're really quite something.
Is there a black market in those or a regular market like on eBay or Etsy or someplace that people sell it?
Actually, I ripped a poster off the wall. I have it on my Instagram page. That is a Rick Griffin piece of art. It's his Frankfurt Fest Hall. It's all in German. And they were stuck on these poster boards. At every show, we were looking at posters, but what they did is they would just glue them onto a wall where there was like 30 or 40, 50, 100 years of other old posters, so you could never take them off. But at the Frankfurt train station, there were four on poster boards, and we took the poster boards down, and then we had to peel back really slowly the poster, and they're about 37 inches wide, 48 inches tall, getting to the ticket stub. And when I ripped mine off right at the bottom, right where it had the date, it said Frankfurt Festhalle on top in German on the bottom, and then it had the date, Acht 22. And in the corner, or it said 22 Acht, because they do their dates differently.
Right. Yeah.
It ripped off in the corner, stuck to the poster board. But then when I, you know, I wrapped it up, I rolled it up, I just jammed it in my backpack, got it home, and, you know, it looks weathered. But then when we put it on the poster board, the 22 was missing. But then I pulled my ticket stub out. I'm like, hey, and the ticket stubs I put in a book. Mm. And we put that right in the corner of the frame. And if my memory serves me correctly, someone about a week or two ago, I know that shirts that we bought for $20 are selling for $500 on eBay. And I think those ticket stubs are going for $200 or $300. It's amazing because you have these young people that are getting into it, so the demand is just, you know, continually rising, and everybody wants a piece of something from the past.
Right, and I can't figure out how they determine the value. It's the same with my books. Books that of mine that came out, say, 20 years ago or even 15 years ago, they'll have, it's like you, someone bought it, that has my signature. And if you don't want to pay $5,000 for it, you can get it for $4.95 from somebody else. I mean, I don't know how they come up with the values of these things.
Or if someone famous like Steve McQueen owned that Mustang that sold, I don't remember, his Mustang and his watch sold for like 200 times more than if it wasn't his.
Yeah, it's like Roger Moore's Volvo 1800, the white one that he drove in the Saint. They brought it over here. And, gee, if you sniff the seats, does it smell like Roger Moore?
How would you know?
How would you know?
I don't want to know the answer to that.
I was at an auction recently for some Hollywood memorabilia. You know, like the Devil Doll from Trilogy of Terror was one of the items.
Ooh.
But the Lost in Space robot,
ooh,
rebuilt, refurbished, fully functional, was there, and it went for almost $350,000.
They go, danger, danger.
God, I had one of those back in the day.
Well, this was the full size.
Full size one.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so didn't they make those little ones in toys, though, right?
Correct, but this was salvaged from all of the old parts and restored.
Well, I wish
just
they could do that
like
with
if
me.
If you had that, in, if you bought an old house and that was up in the attic, and you just scored $350,000 like that, I mean,
that's
incredible.
Well, the Devil Doll from Trilogy of Terror 2,
yeah,
because the original doll is lost or destroyed, that went for a healthy sum, $30,000-$40,000.
What do you do with it after you own it?
You display it.
Right.
You sell it. No, you display it, and if times are you tired of it, you could resell it. Yes, but I mean, if you're going to buy it, it's like you're going, you know, that the Trilogy of Terror, the original Carol Black, those three tales still resonate all those years ago. They were so well done.
Well, that's the thing about quality, is it never goes out of fashion. Hey.
Well, I think that everybody collects. Everything that you think is not worth anything. There's a genre of people that collect it.
Yep, I have.
It could be
all
anything.
The
it could be Marvel
Thrills Illustrated.
1800.
Yeah, Burrow collects some retired hookers.
Mm.
He has some stacked up like cordwood.
I do. Yeah.
Oh my God. You know, I have a bunch of old marbles. I've restored a number of very, very, very old Victorian homes, and I have this one that has, it looks sort of like a piece of bubble gum on the inside. Now, I've never actually tried to price this, because when you buy an old house, sometimes there's a basement full of stuff. Many times I just I sell it. I don't give it away. I kind of see what the value is, but there's always these little knickknacks I've gathered along the way that are just unique and lovely to me. But one day I got lost on the internet till about 2 a.m. and I looked at marbles from like the 1870s, 80s, 90s, and there's some marbles they'll sell for $3,000, $4,000, $5,000. Some are $8,000 or $9,000.
Right, what about Spanish language editions? I have a number one of Hombre Araña, you know, Spider-Man, in Spanish.
And I'm sure there's a market for it. Anything Spider-Man, I don't know the Spanish market, but, I mean, if it was an American market.
It's condition and rarity.
Condition and rarity. And a lot, it's condition and rarity, but it's also like the art. If the artwork on it is that's a big driving factor in the value.
Is this the same artwork?
It varies over time.
I had a collection of comic books. I remember going to the White Hen Pantry in Chicago as a 6-year-old and getting these comics for a nickel. And at some point before I went to prison, I sold them all. But I was just a kid. I probably got like a dollar each. And they probably weren't even worth that back then. But today, some of those, I mean,
my brother.
There's a story of a family that purchased some land, and on the land was a very, very old farmhouse that had been empty for 30 years. When they went in to the farmhouse, they were going to tear it down, so they start a little demolition, and they discover that the walls were insulated with art house movie posters.
Oh, my God.
From the silent era through, you know, the late 30s.
Several treasure trove.
Several thousand of these puppies. And they were all just laid in nice and neat. They weren't folded or crumpled. They're just sitting there. And so they collected them all, put them to the side. And some youngster in the family says, well, these things might be worth something. $2.5 million later.
Wow.
That's like our buddy Punch, Pavle Stadimirovic. His dad, the people who owned all these apartment buildings in New York, there were storage lockers. And people had left stuff in the storage lockers and never came back. And they said, will you clear these out? If there's anything of value in there, you can keep it. My God. Yeah, Tiffany lamps. First edition books that were worth $1 million. You know, classics. Just made a fortune then just in clearing out the old lockers.
They've had that TV show Storage Wars on for a long time.
Yeah, I think hoarders would probably.
Well, no, it's Storage Wars. And they go in and they bid on these delinquent lockers, and they have whatever's in it. And
oh, boy. Well, being as this is a true crime show, I will quickly tell the true story of the fellow who leaves Seattle-Tacoma area and goes to Idaho, gets a new wife, but he has this bill that keeps coming from the storage locker.
Uh-oh.
And she pays it every month. And finally, she goes, well, what the hell am I paying this for the storage locker he's got up in Seattle for? So, and you know, the storage lockers, they auction it off. And they open it up, and there's the body of the guy's wife and his kids.
Oh, my God. I thought you were going to say cocaine.
No, it wouldn't be that lucky. No, it was the dead body of his murdered wife and his murdered children. So they asked the wife, he said, if you had known what was in that storage locker, what would you have done? Like, you know, turn him in or something, right? He goes, oh, I would have kept paying it. What do you mean you keep paying it? He says, well, he was drinking in those days, and he doesn't drink with me, so I figure I'm safe.
She's in denial.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. If he's going to kill his wife and kids, you think maybe he's only one drink away from that degree of violence and insanity. He says, yeah, I would have kept paying it. You wouldn't do that to me. I was like, when I went to the leopard's cage, it didn't occur to me the leopard might rip my face off.
Well, I mean, Gary, what was his name? The green guy killer, Gary.
Ridgway.
You know, Ted Bundy had a wife for a short time. John Wayne Gacy had a wife.
Robert Lee Yates had a wife and five kids and taught Sunday school. And
the BT killer, BTK.
Yeah.
He had a wife and kids.
And he was quite
a
clown.
That's their cover. Yeah, that's their cover.
Yeah, well, that's the thing about Robert Lee Yates. They figured he was bumping people off in Germany. He was over there in the service. And he was killing the hookers in Spokane and in Pierce County. Because he'd go over there.
I remember that story. They got him kind of young, didn't they?
Yeah, well, he was...
In his 50s?
Yeah. And he had, five kids, then a wife. And he had a heck of a hard job. And he also had this girlfriend on the side who was in love with him.
And, I remember that.
And she was Hawaiian. And she would recommend girls for him to date, not knowing that he was killing them.
You know, I think it's like someone addicted to drugs, where they'll hide it. They'll go out, they'll do, the alcohol, they're hiding the bottles, the sneaking, the hits of drugs. I can't see it being, I'm not trying to minimize it, but I think it's some sort of addiction that they just cannot control.
Well, in his case,
they have to fuel or feed that beast.
They've got the fantasy. It's like we hear about pedophiles. Everyone thinks pedophiles do all this horrible stuff to kids. 90-some% of people who have pedophilia, which is sexual attraction to people who are not yet gone through puberty, never do anything wrong. It just stays in their fantasy world. And some of them would like to get some therapy, but the stigma of it is so intense that they don't even want to come forward and say, "Could you help me with these fantasies I have about stooping a 7-year-old? But the vast majority, overwhelming majority, never take any action on the fantasy. Like the guy who fantasized about having sex with a cockroach. You know, think about it a lot, but he never really did it.
Joe's apartment.
Hey, I have a drug use question for you. Being as I'm sure you, I don't know how many times you took LSD or how many times you do. When you first took it, was it still legal?
No, was it still legal? Hell no, it was way illegal.
Yeah, well, first time I did it, it was still legal.
Well, that was at the beginning when Larry was promoting it?
Yeah, this is...
back in the 60s?
Yeah, 65.
Because
65
is when 66. They made it illegal.
Yeah, you have to remember, Burl is an Alta Cocker.
Yeah, I'm an old guy. I'm 76.
Well, you don't look like it on the picture, unless that picture's from 20 years ago.
It's an old picture from 5 years ago.
No, he looks formed over.
But, yeah.
I was always afraid that it was going to make me go crazy. I did a recent interview. I talked a little bit about it. And I'd done mushrooms a few times, and I had dabbled a tiny little bit in selling LSD. And then it finally, I was at the Brendan Byrne, October 15th of 1989, the year anniversary of my father's death. He died right in my arms. And the girl that I had met a couple days before, we were in the show, and she had a sheet. And I think she may have tripped one time before, but I decided we were going to do it, and we did it. And it was a wonderful, beautiful, exceptional experience. And then that sort of showed me the message. And I've done it a handful of times. I wasn't a big abuser of psychedelic drugs because they're just so strong. I mean, that trip, there's so much that you
to process.
See. Like you get brought to the point of the unified field of existence.
The oneness.
The quantum. You get down to
the Dalai Lama didn't get the joke when someone told him the Dalai Lama joke. That is, Dalai Lama at a hot dog hamburger stand, and he says, "Make me one with everything."
And he just handed him a hit of LSD.
Yeah. And he didn't get the joke, though. Someone told him the joke, and he didn't get it.
That's pretty funny.
But make me one with everything.
I think it's a very powerful tool, and I think that if you took everybody fighting in, you know, hopefully I don't get in trouble for saying this, but say you take those people on the Hamas side, and you take the people in Israel, and you take the commanders and you put them in a room, right? And no guns, no nothing, and then you give them all LSD. You know, well, Terrence McKenna would take it a step further and say group sex, but I say that if they would all do it, that they would see each other as a human being. I mean, it really could change the way people look. I mean, if you think about it, it's the 21st century, and we're still fighting with guns. I mean, it just seems so.
Let's see how many of my friends could kill how many of your friends.
Gosh,
it's just insane.
We gotta get past the right and the wrong and who started it with everybody in all the little wars. But it just seems so trite. And if you know, one time I was at Jim Morrison's grave and. When his dad was in Europe, and I believe I met Vladimir Putin there.
Well, was he a Doors fan?
No, he was at Jim Morrison's grave, but he was there and he would hang out, and I think he took LSD from us.
Well, I hate to think what he was like before, because he certainly didn't make him a better guy.
We don't know who he is, though, but I think he's taken LSD, and he was at the grave of Jim Morrison, and it was right around the 90s. And when I was there with Mike and Julian, there was this guy who was just kind of hanging out, you know, and if you look at that time, I think he was just, because that was what, 10, 34 years ago, he was coming up in the ranks
of doing news commentary. He
didn't have a major post at that point, but he was out of the, what is their secret police called?
The KGB.
Yeah, he was in like the Politburo or something, right. But he was traveling around Europe a lot. But we met a guy that was just like that guy. I don't know if it was him, but years later I learned that it might have been him because he would frequent that area. And then when the dead were in town, he would hang out. And the people that would come to Jim Morrison's grave, if you've ever gone there, like people would leave stuff. Like there would be weed and acid and pipes and just right on the grave. It was a whole buffet.
You know, and underwear.
Underwear, used. You know, I met Jim Morrison. July of 1969, Graham Parsons' limo pulls up to the Gold Creek Dome in Woodinville, Washington. And stumbling out of Graham, who became a friend of mine, Graham's limo is Morrison, who's already drunk. And it's early afternoon. And so I walk up and I go, "Hey," I said, "can I do an audio interview with you for Buckley Broadcasting, KOL Radio?" He goes, "You're not from Rolling Stone, are you?" I said, "No." He says, "Good. I won't talk to Rolling Stone. They gave my latest single release a bad review. But I'll talk to you." And here's what I thought was fascinating about what he said, considering how he is so idolized now in his death. He says, "You know one thing that is really important? He says, as a band, we're not into this whole rock star adulation BS. We're just people who make our living playing music and singing songs. And we love our fans. We were just in La Grande, Oregon. And after the show or the next day, we just went out with a bunch of our friends, whatever you want to call them, saw the sights of the city and the beautiful area there in La Grande." He says, "This whole thing of idolizing rock performers," he says, "I don't get it at all." Well, of course, he winds up dead and he's idolized now. He's probably rolling over in his grave.
Well, didn't somebody steal his corpse once?
No.
That was Graham Parsons.
Ah.
I wonder how much you could sell that for.
I don't know.
Well, there's a whole subculture of murderapedia artifacts, and that people pay top dollar for some of it.
Yes.
There is a picture that was posted on Facebook about the rock festival that I kind of hosted, emceed, introduced acts or whatever. And that's when Graham Parsons, Flying Burrito Brothers, formerly of the Birds, gave me what we call Dupe Check's Revenge, which was window paint acid from Czechoslovakia. And he wanted me to introduce the band, you know, when it was time for them to go on. But he'd given me this acid. I was underneath the stage, very comfortably hallucinating and having a wonderful time. When his band was going, Burl, where are you? And I go, well, I'm down here. And he goes, well, the Flying Burrito Brothers are going on stage, and Graham wants you to introduce the act. So they help me go up the stairs, which is kind of like, you know, going up the Great Wall of China or something.
Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah. So I get out on stage for 30,000 people there, and I bring on the band, and Graham's at the piano, and they start playing whatever their first tune is. And instead of leaving the stage, I just walked over and leaned against Graham's piano for the entire set. I was leaning against the piano.
That's awesome.
Listening to him sing. And he kept looking up at me, cracking up, laughing. He was a great guy. And the weird thing about him, you know, is he died of a heroin overdose, which is tragic. He's into opioids. He was the only person I have ever known that no matter what drugs he took, whether they were opiates or psychedelics or alcohol, or if he mixed them all together, there was no perceptible change in his demeanor or his behavior.
He had a strong constitution.
Well, whoever wasn't strong enough, because he died. But he was a super nice guy.
He probably just got some stuff that was a little stronger than normal, and he was alone, and no one could bring him back.
Yeah, what was it, in Switzerland, or where they have, you know, if you're a heroin addict, there isn't a stigma to it anymore.
Portugal is one of them.
Yeah, well, this is one of the Scandinavian countries. We only had one overdose death of heroin in the entire year, and that's because this person, instead of getting their morning shot at the little kiosk clinics they have, we can get you a shot on the way to work or whatever for maintenance, went off by himself and did it. That was the only overdose death in the entire country.
Uh-huh. We're becoming a little more enlightened, I believe. I mean, the governor of Colorado just decriminalized mushrooms. Seattle and Oakland and Portland, I believe, have decriminalized drugs, but there's a little bit of a problem with homelessness in the downtown area, so there's going to be some growing pains. But the reality of the situation is I've talked to people who have had sons and daughters that have OD'd on heroin, and if they sit there and talk to me for long enough, I can get them to the point usually of, like, because when you first say, well, if you tell them that, well, if heroin was legal, your son wouldn't have died. But the reality of the situation is when you go to these places to get your fix, they make you sign a piece of paper. They let you know that if you ever need help, you're here. And then you do your shot and you're in a safe environment. So legalization is different than decriminalization, because when it's legal, they're not just going to give it away. But the reality of the situation, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, is making it illegal hasn't worked.
No. Anytime you make something secret that you got to hide, there's going to be problems.
Prohibition, anyone?
Yeah, well, look at prohibition and alcohol. That's why you've got all these former narcs, you know, narcotics agents, who form law enforcement against prohibition. And they don't say how to do it, but they do want it decriminalized, because the reason for the decriminalization as opposed to legalization is that with legalization, it's still controlled by the same people who controlled it when it was illegal.
Okay, I just looked it up right now. I Googled it. Overdose deaths 2023 United States. United States, 109,183, June of 2023. And I think they started in 1981 and they recorded 600 overdose deaths. So that number, I mean, what kills 109,000 people a year? I don't know. That's got to be a serious thing, right? And the other thing is, if you look at the greed of it, if it was legal, the Mexican cartels would be put out of business overnight.
Oh, sure, that's what's happened when they legalized marijuana.
I guarantee you, in some back way, they are lobbying to not have drugs legal. There's some way that they're fighting.
Oh, it's just because there's too much money and corruption. That's why.
Yeah, but the thing is, you know, you're older than me, but 25 years ago, if you said there's going to be a black president and marijuana would be legal, which I was always hoping would be true, people would tell you you're crazy. But look, how many states is marijuana legal in? 26? I mean, the tide is sort of turning, right? I mean, it's changing. Hemp is legal everywhere because of the farm bill.
Do you remember Ronald Reagan?
Yes, just say no. That was the worst thing. And then addict herself. I'm sorry, I'm rambling.
So prior to Reagan instituting the war on drugs, the U.S. government had its own marijuana field and grew and distributed marijuana either in cigarette or pill form, THC pills.
For medicinal
purposes. And then you would apply to this program, get a card, and then you could go to the distribution places around the country, give them the card, and they'd give you your marijuana. So Reagan goes and says, there's war on drugs. We got to get rid of this scourge. And behind the scenes, some officials come up and go, are you aware that we know that it has medicinal value and that we're giving it away to all these patients? And it was embarrassing. God. So Reagan said, shut up. Close the program for new patients. And attrition will take care of the rest.
Well, I can remember when on CBS TV, they had that special on treating alcoholism with psychedelics.
With LSD.
Yeah. And Bill W. swore by it.
Yes. He took it for 5 years. LAVA. They've had exceptional success in I don't know what they did with Bill, but actually when I was in prison, the first federal prison I arrived at, Diane Sawyer, what was that show, 2020? Or that other woman, not Diane Sawyer.
Erin Moriarty?
She's a good-looking blonde. She's still doing interviews. Tough woman. But she did a 2-hour special on it, and I was just like, oh my God, because I'm in prison for LSD, because they were thinking about changing some of the laws with marijuana and LSD for the sentences. But they showed a big part of the 2-hour special was that they showed this woman who was very old, and she was the daughter of a alcoholic. And what they did is they did these because they were doing them everywhere, but these were around Jefferson's home was, Monticello. It was some research center, like right in that same area. And they took the father, they gave him the LSD they got a license from the government. And this was in like the late 50s or early 60s, but they had enough foresight to film it. And what they did is they took him on a bad trip, and they showed him why alcohol was bad. And then over the hours they were with him, and then they brought him to where the law of him could be if he stopped drinking. And so he had died, but his daughter was there. She was much older, and she said that LSD saved our family, saved our life. My dad never took alcohol again. He was completely, changed. And so it's a powerful drug, and I wouldn't recommend someone just to take it, but I think that under the right conditions, because it's all about context. I mean, if you take
And quite the thing is, you have a short attention span theater when you're on that stuff. So I just thought that someone was having a bad trip. All I had to do was change the lighting and change the music.
Exactly.
and he'd come back. And a good friend of mine, who might even be listening for all I know, he had, for some reason, an unpleasant experience. And I said, well, and it really bothered him afterwards. I mean, not just while it was happening, but in his day-to-day life afterwards, it bothered him. And I just made the assumption that, well, if I give you a real good one, where everything goes smooth as silk, you know, you're like replacing, you know, reprogramming. And sure enough, it was this absolutely beautiful day, beautiful event. Everything was perfect. He had a wonderful, affirming, positive experience, and the problems he had from the bad one went away. We're gone.
I remember one time in Oakland, California, right before a dead show, there was about 20 of us in a hotel room, not sleeping, but and we all took a tab or two or three, and then I was pontificating up on the milk crate for about 45 minutes, and then we all went into the show. And I mean, it was the most beautiful thing in the world. And it's nothing that I ever abused, and it wasn't like the next day I woke up and I'm like, you know, I want it again, like a hit of cocaine or something. Yeah. It's just, you got that message, and it was so powerful. And I think today there's still parts of it that I'm trying to decipher, not good or bad, but just the reality of knowing that you can go to this space where it's like the quantum space of the oneness. And so meditating, I can get there today.
Right.
I'm a yoga nidra teacher, which is an ancient form of kundalini yoga. It's a meditation.
Hey, you got to be careful with that kundalini energy. You don't want to blow the top of your head off.
Oh, my.
No, but you get to the space of the unified field of oneness, and there is no, it's beyond duality. You have all the answers, but there's no questions. Like,
yeah.
You just...
Well, that's why I'm so fascinated with all these Marvel movies where they're talking about the multiverse in all the different dimensions. And I think that's wonderful because the younger generation is, you know, just into that. Oh, yeah, there's 5, 6, or 13 different versions of me somewhere.
Well, there's according to quantum mechanics, there may be an infinite number of parallel universes.
Yeah.
Well, if there's an infinity, if there's truly an infinity, right, which is beyond almost human comprehension, that means in some other world, in some other universe, right now, at this minute, this second, someone's doing the exact same interview with the same people with the same clothes on, because it's infinite. Mm-hmm. It's an infinite. And like in my 12-step program, because I used to drink a little too much, when I put myself on one outcome or a situation where I pick a something that I think should happen, I'm limiting myself because the outcomes are absolutely, like if you were a betting man, right, and you wanted this one thing to happen, but you were hoping and betting on this one thing, and I know I'm kind of being vague, like if you put a bet on that, well, I would bet against it every time because the other possibilities are infinite. So I try to set my goals specific, but also like open to the possibility of that anything can happen.
Well, that's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that modern physics bases itself on. That until an observation is made, all outcomes are possible. And there's the ubiquitous cat in a box, and the cat may have been poisoned and died or may not. And you don't know until you open the box and look.
But until you look, it could be anything.
Well, when you look and you go and you see the cat lying there not breathing, it's dead.
Then you know.
Wait, but until that moment that you look, the cat is said to be in both states.
Yeah, like if a tree falls in the forest and you don't hear the sound, that's called the Heisenberg hypothesis.
Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Uncertainty principle.
And modern quantum mechanics is based on it because the whole concept of the Schrodinger equation and the uncertainty principle is everything is probability. You cannot stop or pinpoint a state, a quantum state. Exactly. You can calculate the possibility of it being in any one particular state. But well, you can never know for sure because
that's like the burning bush.
Because well, I'm a Reformed Jewish Druid and worship the burning bush.
The biology of belief.
Because in the burning bush, he says, "Who do I say?" He says, "It's the imperative form of to be is what I will be whatever I will be at any given moment," and that so the Creator transcends completely his its creation. And the concepts of time and egress, etc., regress, any of those things. And there's some great Jewish philosophers talking about that you can't ascribe finality and exclusivity to any divine revelations because you just can't. It's beyond that, beyond any definition. Or restrictions.
I'm sure you've heard of the advent of quantum computing. That's at the beginning of its travails.
Yes.
In a traditional computer, your desk, your laptop, your desktop, or even the large giant computers, the IBM or the supercomputers, they all store the information in fixed format in some electronic form. And, you know, you either have an on or an off. But at the quantum level, that doesn't exist. There's three possible states. On, off, or not, or neither. And all of the techniques used to establish the state of a particular on-off value, the act of observation resets to the original state.
The act of observation, that's the key.
Right. So you have, you know, and the math is quite annoying. It's not as complicated as quantum mechanics, but it's still almost entirely in the complex plane. And your programming is no longer the same. You can't ask an if question, you know, is it on or is it off? You have to ask, what's the probability of it being on or off? And then I suspect over the next 20 to 25 years, they'll figure out how to make it, reasonably accurate enough for it to be in general use. But there are a number of places, IBM for one, Google for another, where there's a public quantum computer just sitting there, and you can request a login and have fun.
It's all beyond me.
Ah.
I mean, even Fortran punched those little holes in the cards.
Hollerith cards, yes. That was
it's called public quantum computer.
Excuse me?
It's called public quantum computer.
Yeah, yes, you can just look up quantum computing, IBM or Google, and it's just out there.
There it is, right here. World's largest publicly available quantum computer. I see it online right now.
Right, but you're going to have some knowledge of AND gates, NOR gates, and adders and multipliers. There's some really good introductory books that are available that describe the techniques used to build components that let you do computing. But there's nothing. There's not a large scale symbolic language that could be used for general processing yet. But they're getting there.
Well, you have the Neuralink in our brain.
Yeah, well, people have come up with all sorts of explanations for things that they created their own little mind, and they're going to stick to it. And I said, just no matter how many people believe that thunder is the sound of elves bowling in the sky, does not mean there are really elves bowling in the sky.
No, no.
I mean, the number of people who believe something doesn't make it true.
No, but there are riders in the storm.
There are riders in the storm. In the wreck of the,
there's an entire contingent of people that think the world is still flat.
Flat.
That just boggles my mind. I met one, and he also flies planes. You can't put together your flight plan without acknowledging that the world is not flat.
The earth, right.
When the great long-term travel on the in the seas in the 1400s, 1500s, they knew the world was round.
They knew
because they were using the stars to navigate. And if the world was flat, that wouldn't work.
Ah, that reminds me.
But that's another.
I would remind the literalists, the biblical literalists, that the stars are going to fall on the earth. Well, the stars happen to be far larger than the earth. It would be like throwing a spitball into the furnace.
Well, yeah.
However, what are stars used for? Guidance, like clergy. You know, what people that you would look to for guidance and clarity fall on the earth of their worldly desires that are corrupted. You can't trust them. You know, that makes far more sense than thinking suddenly stars are going to be smaller than the earth. And, you know.
So I was just curious. You were made an example of in your original trial, and you went to where did you start your incarceration?
I started in the county jail, but I started in a low at Sandstone, Minnesota, then I went to Inglewood, Colorado, then Florence, Colorado, then Pekin, Illinois, then Talladega, Alabama. Then in Talladega, Alabama, there were the crack law riots, and then I was sent to Marion in the 1990s, which was 23-hour lockdown. So the solitary confinement, that was the reckoning of sorts.
And what was your involvement in the riot?
Say that again?
What was your involvement in the riot?
There was no involvement, and that kind of was the crux of the whole book, was the race and then the way that the drug laws were playing into the riot. But there was an incident that I had with a lieutenant with a green duffel bag. And we got that's a long story. I can get into it. But that bag was taken away, and it was quasi-illegal because I had it three prisons before, but I had a fake property slip, and, like, each store will sell something different, so when you get shipped to another prison, you have this thing called a property slip. But once he took that bag from me, we got into it pretty bad, and then I started filing these complaints with, like, a BP-9, BP-10, BP-11, BP-12. But then I stopped because at some point he said to me, he said, if you keep filing those complaints, I'm going to send you to Marion. And it was just a stupid duffel bag. And I laughed at him because he called me into his office. And then I just thought to myself, it's just a green duffel bag. It doesn't matter. But when the riot, so many months later in Talladega, these riots happened over the crack law. They had changed the LSD law, the methamphetamine law, and the marijuana law to make it a little easier on the sentencing. And those, for the most part, affected white defendants. And then the same sentencing commission decided to change the crack law, because the crack law was like 100-1. I mean, it was
Out
there. Does it matter if I get drunk drinking 151 or beer? I mean, I'm still drunk. I'm going to get the OWI if they catch me while I'm driving. They don't say, well, if you were drinking beer, you're going to get a lesser sentence. So the riots happened, buildings were burnt to the ground, guards were beaten, and they took 22 black defendants and me, a white guy, and they sent us all to Marion. And and half the guys that went back to Marion with me, went to Marion, got more time on their sentences. Not everyone was involved in the riot. We were all charged as if we were started the riot. I actually got a shot that said I leaded and organized the whole riot.
Oh, what? Why don't you put that on your resume?
I do. And the thing is, but in the first prison I was at, there was a certain reckoning of sorts. Like, you implode because you can't believe you're there. You explode. You want to do anything you can to get out, and then you accept. And that happened in the very first place, and I didn't realize that till I got out, till I really did an inventory of being there. But the acceptance part helped me. Now, Marion was unbelievable, 23-hour lockdown, but there was a certain, in all the prisons, there was just a certain respect amongst races. There was a culture of honor among races that was thick, and like, you there was still a line. They're like, you know, what's his name? Walk the line. Who sang that song?
Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash. You have to walk the line. I mean, if you're weak, you're going to get beaten and raped. If you're acting too tough, you're going to get beaten by your own race. But, there was a code. And each prison that I got transferred to was a little more serious. But Marion was the apex of the world at the time. Like, you had to walk that line, but it was always the convict against the man. It was never like when you're there, you're a stranger in a strange land. There's rules that you don't make, but you have to follow. You will not buck that system. I don't care who you are, especially in a place like Marion. But if you disrespected another inmate that was another race, you know, towards the guards, your own race would just discipline the hell out of you, possibly stab and kill you, because it would mess up the order of how the yard was run. And so there was, you're still in a place of wickedness and evil, but there is this sense of respect amongst races that in this TikTok world of America today, it just seems there's a lot of, I don't think it's as bad as they make it seem, but they do make it seem out here that there's a lot of racial strife. I think people
look for a reason why their lives aren't the way they like it, so they try to find some external reason, something to blame. Oh, yeah, it's those lizards. Or it's the Jews, or it's the blacks, or Mexicans.
You also are missing the innate need of human beings to belong.
Yeah, some people want to belong to crackpot.
Well, that's prison is an extreme situation of that, where you can't just be arbitrary in what you belong to, but you have to go with whatever it is you are, if you're white or you're black or you're Hispanic or whatever.
Exactly.
Right, but that's much more heightened. But people just have a need to feel that they're not alone, whatever it is that they feel. And if they can find a group that feels that way and join it, that they're much happier, whether it be religion or any other particular feeling. But then you witnessed something interesting at Chow in Marion along these lines.
No, that was before Marion.
Oh, that was?
I did. That was in Florence, Colorado. The chow halls were always divided with a black line and a white line, and they had the same food. And that blew me away, right? I just was, and so this was the first, second, third prison I was in. It was morning time, it was breakfast, and I'm probably held between 275 and 350 people, you know, and you would come in, you'd get 25 minutes to eat, you got 8 or 9 units. And I don't know, we were the second or third unit in, and there might have been 10 guards, 8 guards. And so that's a place where if someone gets out of line, like you're in big trouble with the cops, because there's so many people that they're in danger. Even if there were 12 or 15 of them, there's 10, 12 at the most, there's 350 guys. You could just take them over. So an Indian, Native American Indian, came in, and we had a big batch of hooch that came down. It was really strong, and the rules were you would always never sell it to an American Indian. That was sort of the thing, like if you just wouldn't. But someone did. He drank a lot of it. Probably did it like before the line came in, because he was lit up, and he just went at these guards, and they hit the deuces. But they just pulled their clubs out, and these are clubs with lead in the middle. They're wicked, man. They will crack your skull, one shot. and they got the little T-handle. So they just started marauding him viciously. It was brutal. I mean, it was for anybody. And so, like, I wasn't a shot caller. I was, you know, I had big workout partners, and there was a place, there was a lot of weed on the compound. It was a good place to do time. And if you had to do time. And so then all of a sudden, two guys from the white side look over to the black side. It's all a big open area. They point, they immediately huddle, and I'm like, holy shit. And everybody's just kind of like seeing this. We didn't know for why he did it. We didn't know he was drunk, but we figured it out at the end. And so they go, and they think, okay, you take him, you take him. So they take a white guy, they take a black guy, and they point. Like, it just happened so quick, like they knew. And they go in, not to fight the guards, but to sort of, like, stop. They're swinging the baton. And then so now they start to get beat, getting beaten, but not as bad because they're not fighting back. Like, the Indian took his cup, which I think it might have still had some booze in it, and he just walked up to one of the guards and cold cocked him. And so it's maybe 60 to 90 seconds, white guy, black guy, go in. Then by that time, maybe 15, 20 seconds later, as they alleviate some of the beating on the Indian, and now they're getting beat, but there's only 10 of them.
Well, this will probably take another sentence in prison to finish the story, but unfortunately we're out of time.
No, so then they hit the deuces, and then everybody comes running back in with all the police. But my point of that story is, if I didn't see it, I wouldn't believe it. If someone was telling me that story, I almost wouldn't believe it. But then after it all went away, I was like, wow. Like,
wow.
That's some humanity, though.
Yeah.
That's humanity.
Well, listen, this exercise in humanity must come to an end, as we've run out of time, and although time's an illusion, it's one we live with.
Joe Besseler, Letters from Marion. It's a really good book.
And you got another book coming out too, don't you?
The new one's called Crime School. That'll be out shortly. And Letters from Marion is on Kindle and Nook. It's available right now, $9.95. The hardcover is out of print, so you can probably find one used. I've seen them as low as $5 and as high as $100. There's a couple out there.
Yeah, well, they're hoarding those first editions. We'll have you out again, and we won't wait. How many years has it been?
Six
years.
Great.
Six or 8 years. Thanks, Joel.
I'm working on a movie deal. There's somebody in Hollywood. I can't say, but we've been in talk.